I think science at least begins to touch upon a profound metaphysical and religious type question.
This degree of fine-tuning is so extreme that it really forces the God of the Bible as the only possible explanation for why the universe would have this incredibly high measure of design in it.
What evolutionary biologists now are left with are two problems. Gradualism is not validated by the fossil record, and punctuated equilibrium doesn't have a mechanism that works.
Logic indicates that there has to be a God who moves but is himself unmoved.
Put everything to the test. Hold fast to that which is good.
Welcome to Creation Update, sponsored by Reasons to Believe. This is the show where we keep you in touch with the latest scientific discoveries and how they provide powerful new evidence for the God of the Bible. Featuring Fuzz Rana, Kenna Samples, Jeff Swearing, David Rogstad, Krista Bontrager, and Hugh Ross. Here they are, the Reasons to Believe Scholar Team.
Welcome, everybody, to Creation Update. This is the program where we explore the harmony between God's two revelations, the words of the Bible and the record of nature. It's October 11th. We're broadcasting live from our studios here at Reasons to Believe, and I am not Krista Bontrager, as you hopefully could gather from the voice, but rather I'm Fuzz Rana. I'm sitting in for Krista, who is away for a couple of weeks. I'm joined in studio today with Hugh Ross, who is the founder and president of Reasons to Believe, which is the organization that sponsors this broadcast, Dave Rogstad, a physicist, and former JPL employee. Got too much going there too fast. And Jeff Swearing, an astronomer. And I'm a biochemist, and you're probably thinking it's time for me to tune this program off. But we promise that we will be intelligible and clear and concise as we talk about how the latest discoveries this past week or so in science support the Christian faith. If you're listening to us as a rebroadcast on the Living Way Radio Network, we welcome you to the program as well and invite you to send emails to us if you have questions about what we're doing here at Reasons to Believe. The email address, if you're interested, is creationupdate@reasons.org. Creationupdate, one word, @reasons.org. Send us an email. Let us know that you've been listening to us on the Living Way Radio Network. If you want to join the program, your calls are taken and welcomed at 866-RTB-RADIO, 866-RTB-RADIO. That's 866-782-7234. And we've got a very full show for you today. We're going to be talking about rise in oxygen levels and what that means for a biblical creation model. Hugh's going to give us an update on what he's been doing the last few weeks. He's been away from the program, and we're going to find out what Hugh's been up to, and we're going to learn about a discovery that Hugh made regarding a common objection or an increasingly prevalent objection to the Christian faith, and that'll be coming up shortly. We want to talk a little bit about Hermann Bondi, a well-known astrophysicist who died recently, and we want to reflect on his life and what his work meant for the Christian faith. We also have a discovery dealing with gamma ray bursts and afterglows discovered from those gamma ray bursts, and has nothing to do with the prom, but rather is a very important discovery that, again, supports the Christian faith. And, of course, we want to hear from you. Your calls, your emails are welcome. Well, gentlemen, why don't we begin by looking at this discovery that appears to be published in a recent issue of Science dealing with oxygen levels over the past 200 or in 5 million years. Hugh, Jeff, why don't you guys kind of take it away here?
Well, it's nine paleontologists and geologists, all of them Americans, who published this article in the most recent issue of Science. And it's based on some sediment core drills. They're in the marine sediment core drills, mainly in the Atlantic Ocean area. And so they did these deep drills through the sediment at the bottom of the ocean, and were able to recover a record of the carbon-13 abundance over the past 205 million years.
And so what does the carbon-13 abundance indicate?
Well, Fuzz, you're the biochemist here. We're talking about the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13.
So those are two different isotopes of carbon.
Those are two different isotopes of carbon, and as you've told many people in the air here before, life favors carbon-12 over carbon-13. And life is predominantly over the past 205 million years anaerobic life. And therefore, by looking at the carbon-13 abundance in these sediment cores, they can determine two things. The rate at which organic material is being buried into the crust of the Earth, and that would correlate also with the oxygen content in the atmosphere. And so what they're trying to do is two things, trying to figure out the rate of burial of carbon, organic carbon, but also primarily getting a record of the oxygen abundance over the past 205 million years. And they wind up publishing in this article a plot of what the oxygen abundance was like over the past 205 million years. 205 million years ago was only 10% by volume in the atmosphere. By comparison, today it's 21%. But it shows that from 205 million years ago to about 50 million years ago, it went through rather dramatic oscillations in the abundance, but never got above 17%. So it stayed below 17% until 50 million years ago. Then from 50 million to 40 million, it jumped up to 21%. And for the last 40 million years, it's hovered between 20% and 23%. It's at 21% right now. And the authors make a big deal about the fact that where you see the oxygen abundance go up in this core sediment time record, you also see that correlate with the appearance of large body size, high metallic, high metabolic rate animals. And so they say, you know, they're trying to claim that the increase of oxygen in the atmosphere was responsible for these speciation events of these large body size, highly metabolic rate creatures.
Well, I know that 50 million years ago is a particularly significant time frame in the fossil record, because that's where you see an explosive diversification of mammals. It's called the mammalian radiation.
Right.
And the duration of that event is so narrow, it really is difficult to envision that being an evolutionary process. It looks like a creation event.
It really does. And to try to blame it on an oxygen increase is a bit problematic, especially problematic because, you know, you do have it hovering around 17% for tens of millions of years before the 50 million year increase, and it only goes up by 4%. And it goes up rather linearly rather than suddenly. But they also make the point that when it hits around 20-21%, you see another radiation. Not the radiation of birds and mammals in diverse forms, but you see a radiation of those birds and mammals that have exceptionally large body size, which would have higher oxygen demands. But, you know, so I looked at their plot of the oxygen abundance as it increases with time. Only until 40 million years ago could you count on it being stable above 20%. Previous to that, there were times when it came up as high as 17%, but then it dropped rapidly. And so from a creator's perspective, he knows exactly what the oxygen abundance is going to be for the next little while. And therefore, it makes sense from an intelligent creator perspective that he would make these large body size birds and mammals starting 40 million years ago, because that's when he knows that the oxygen content will remain stable above that high abundance level, whereas previously you couldn't count on that. And then if you're also going to claim that oxygen is responsible for these speciation events, you have to look in the past record, the past 170 million years, and there were times when it hit significant peaks in the abundance, where it would go from, say, 11% up to 17%, and yet nothing significant happened at that time, and then it would drop down again. Again, that would make sense from a creator's perspective because, you know, the creator would know, okay, it's going to go from 11% to 17%, but it's only going to stay there a million years or so, and it's going to drop back down. This is not a good time to make those creatures, whereas 40 million years ago or 50 million years ago, this wouldn't have been a good timing. And I think from our perspective, Fuzz, our speciation model demonstrates that the larger the body size, the higher the metabolic rate, the lower the probability for evolutionary advance. And with creatures, what we're talking about is birds and mammals with large body size. Those are the creatures that our mathematical speciation model demonstrates has a zero probability of evolutionary advance. And so, therefore, we would say this is great what they've done in terms of documenting what's happening with the oxygen, but it's problematic, their presumption that this would drive through natural means the evolution that we see. And then there's one more thing, and maybe Jeff can comment on this too. I think there's some good design arguments here, Jeff, about, you know, the mechanisms that bring about the lowering of the oxygen content, the burial of the carbon, and then the increase in the oxygen. And so, you know, I look at what's in this article and say, wow, this really demonstrates some fine-tuning here in order to have the burial rates just right and the oxygen production at the just right levels.
Right. Well, and then one other thing that I thought was very interesting out of this that it's a little hard to convey over the radio, but in this paper they show this plot of, you know, as the oxygen level increases, and they plot that versus time, and then they also go and plot the different mammalian species, and, you know, and what you see is that, you know, right about between 40 and 50,000 or million years ago, there are this... of the fossil record, there's this whole lot or a whole bunch of different lines of these new mammalian species that are there, and then they basically remain the same over the next 50 million years. But they all occur right at the same time, and then, you know, presumably, you know, they show that maybe 10 million years before that there was this first large mammalian species, but there's no record of anything before that, but you have all of them sitting there right at that time. And so there's this kind of distinct continuity that happens to coincide just with this rise of oxygen in the atmosphere.
Yeah, big bang of speciation events does not fit a naturalistic model.
Right.
But it would fit a creation model. I mean, this is kind of akin to the Cambrian explosion.
Exactly.
Yeah, let me make sure I understand this. That you're saying that what they're arguing is that the presence, the evolution of these creatures, these mammalian, large-scale or large-sized mammals, brought about the increase in the oxygen content?
No, the other way around, that the increase right. in oxygen brought about the evolution of
okay.
these large
brought
body
about
size.
A fast evolution.
Yeah. Right.
That increase of oxygen being possible because you have the supercontinent Pangaea separating and you've got more coastal waters, which means you have more plankton that can be there, you know, more nutrients.
So this brings about the oxygen
correct,
increase,
yeah.
and then that produces the mammals.
That's right. what an evolutionist would argue.
Would argue. And that's what they're arguing in this paper.
Exactly. But the point here is that when you look at the patterns of appearance in the fossil record, that really is inconsistent with an evolutionary process. It seems more consistent with a creator intervening to bring about suddenly
right.
the appearance of these diverse mammal forms.
And the argument that you were using, Hugh, was that when the oxygen increased in these previous times, there wasn't any particularly quick evolution.
There wasn't, but from a creator's perspective, you would anticipate that because this is an oxygenation event that's
brief.
Rather than one that's going to last a long time.
He would know that.
He would know that,
right.
whereas
okay.
the natural evolutionary processes wouldn't.
Well, one interesting aspect of this increase in oxygen levels is the mechanism which drives it. You know, very often what's kind of a growing picture, I think, of the development of Earth and the introduction of life is that it's not that there are many inputs as to what causes a change. There's astronomical inputs. You know, the sun decreased its intensity and has been growing in intensity. And so there are various things that need to happen for advanced life to be available or possible on the planet. You know, you've got to isolate all the metals, you know, do things like that. The main mechanism that is driving this increase in oxygen is that, you know, we had this supercontinent, is called Pangaea, this particular one. And what is responsible for a lot of the production of the oxygen in our atmosphere is actually the marine phytoplankton and marine organisms. And so if you have all the land mass of the Earth pushed into one continent, what you have is very small or a relatively small amount of continental shelf for these organisms to thrive in. And so what you see corresponding with this increase in oxygen in the atmosphere is this breakup of this continent. And what that does is now instead of having all the landmass concentrated, you have a much more continental shelf area. And so that is the mechanism by which the oxygen level is now being able to increase to these levels, which will now support large mammalian bodies, you know. And so, you know, again, it's very consistent with this picture of a creator says, okay, we need to have this needs to be in place for large mammalian bodies. So let's make that happen. You know, and again, it's a geologic mechanism that's providing and allowing for these developed and advanced species.
So, in other words, there's this really complex interaction of a number of components and number of factors that have to come together in a just right way in order for the Earth's environment to be transformed in such a way to make it ultimately suitable for advanced mammals, large body advanced mammals.
Correct, yeah. You know, I think you know, you look. There are other times in the Earth's history where there have been supercontinents that have broken up, but this is probably the first time where there was sufficiently small concentrations of metals and other things that are going on that permit the large increase in oxygen. You know, so there's multiple factors playing into that, and they all happen to happen. And lo and behold, right when that happens, we see this plethora of advanced mammalian species occur very rapidly, and then they basically stayed the same over the last 40 million
right,
years.
Right, and I think a key point would be that you disrupt or you interfere with any one of these numerous components in this mechanism or interaction of mechanisms, and life isn't possible, or advanced large body mammals are not possible.
This particular development of life, yes.
But on the other hand, if you're an evolutionist, even if all these factors line up and coincide, there's nothing really in the evolutionary theory that compels evolution to happen. In other words, we should be able to look at periods of time in Earth's history where everything is lining up just right and nothing is really happening from an evolutionary perspective. But the fact that we see things happening explosively with such rapidity that it defies an evolutionary process, mm-hmm. and then that always seems to occur or coincide with the alignment of all these different factors, to me, is evidence for God's involvement throughout life's history.
I mean, the thing that I saw the authors miss in this paper is a miracle that this planet has 21% oxygen. You know, it takes incredible fine-tuning to get it up there. And as Jeff is pointing out, you know, this is the creator saying, I want to make these big body-sized mammals and birds. I'm going to need lots of oxygen in the atmosphere, and therefore he designs the tectonics of the Earth just right in order to allow the marine photosynthetic life to generate that quantity of oxygen.
But if you have too much oxygen, that isn't good either.
That's true. Anything above 23%, and you're looking at widespread forests and grass fires over all the continental land masses, and also it's not good for the large body-sized creatures. I mean, I had a friend when I was a teenager, and he was a jet fighter pilot. And in those days, they would feed them a high oxygen concentration gas as they were flying these planes. This guy wound up dying before he was 50 years of age because he had so much oxygen going through his body, given the amount of flying he was doing, that he wound up just kind of burning himself out. Hmm. So too much oxygen for mammals and birds is just as big of a problem as too little. And, of course, then you got the fire problem.
And really, when you look at the mechanism by which oxygen levels are controlled in the record of nature, mainly it's the byproduct of photosynthetic activity, who's to say that these photosynthetic organisms couldn't just keep pumping out oxygen?
Yeah,
are other factors that have to be mitigating oxygen production once it gets above a certain level. So there's just incredible fine-tuning that you see.
Mm-hmm. I'm struck by something here, too. This seems to be kind of a geological control mechanism, as we've said earlier, the breakup of the continent providing more marine environment, essentially, where these organisms. It's analogous in a way to the other mechanism for controlling the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere over the life of the Earth. Its gradual increase decrease to compensate for the increased intensity of the sun, and that was not geological. That was more what kind of life form was present on the Earth that was controlled. Am I right there, Hugh?
That's right.
And so there's a sort of a. This is a geological control mechanism that God has provided. The other was a life form mechanism that God provided.
Right. Yeah, to get the kind of life that God wants, you got to make sure you create a rather wide diversity of life forms at just the right population levels in just the right locations. Then you want the continents to be the just right size and the just right shape and orientation. How you orient the continents is critical as to whether or not you can have creatures as advanced as us on planet Earth.
For people who are listening to this discussion and would like to learn more about how these types of fine-tuning with regard to life's history and Earth's history relate to the Christian faith, what type of resources would we recommend? Of course, people can go to our website at reasons.org, and there's a lot of information along these lines that we have available. But what book would you recommend, Hugh, that people take a look at?
Well, for a book, I'd say the one that's most comprehensive on all those subjects would be The Creator and the Cosmos. Get the third edition. We do have a lot more detail in the Faint Sun Paradox in the Origins of Life book. And then the DVD, Journey Toward Creation, gets into a lot of this material.
Great. So there's three resources that people can check out if they're interested in this topic and, again, want to learn more about how the Creator's hand has carefully shaped this planet to make life possible. Okay, I promised that I would take a phone call here. So why don't we go ahead and go to Morgan. Hello, Morgan. How are you doing?
Hey, good. Just the man I was looking to talk to, actually.
Oh, good, good. You know, I got a long email from you on my desk, so I'm sort of aware of the types of questions that you have, but why don't you go ahead and ask your question there, Morgan?
Okay. Well, I mean, the email is a lot more specific, but unfortunately, I work a goofy shift, and I'm almost on my way out the door right now, but I thought I'd call and try to squeeze in. Maybe you could expand maybe with email, too, but I guess in really short form, how would your model, as far as human origins go, compensate for pre-modern art, such as the, forgive me if I pronounce this wrong, but the Barraquette ram figurine, that's very, very old, or the Tan-Tan figurine, that's actually got pigment applied to it from Morocco, the ox rib that was found, that, I mean, this is interpretation too, I think, but that supposedly had a precursor to writing, had, you know, engravings on it and things of that nature that were not of human origin.
Okay, that's a great question. Not to deflect the question, but we do have a fairly extensive discussion of the relationship between the archaeological record and the appearance of modern humans, where we argue that when you look at the archaeological record in its entirety, I'm sorry, that the source for that discussion is in the book Who Was Adam that Hugh Ross and I have just released, published through NAV Press. So we do spend a fair amount of time talking about this issue. Mm-hmm. And the point that we make in the book is that when you look at the archaeological record comprehensively, what becomes fairly apparent is that there is an explosion of art and music that coincides with the appearance of modern humans, and that there are a couple of instances where in the archaeological record it does appear as if you could make an argument that this behavior appeared prior to the appearance of modern humans, and we discuss some of those archaeological finds in the book, but we point out that in many instances there's a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty surrounding those finds in terms of the precise date, and other factors may complicate the analyses, like mixing of layers of you know, geological layers and things like that, that may make things more complicated. Plus,
you're talking about more complicated for those few that seem to appear before,
right? Exactly.
Man.
In other words, what you end up seeing is instances where there appears to be this find that would predate the appearance of modern humans that looks as if it might be more sophisticated behavior than you typically see in the Middle Stone Age or with the hominids that preceded modern humans. But when you examine the details of those sites, it looks as if there may have actually been mixing, that there were multiple occupations of those sites, and it could be that those artifacts actually are produced by modern humans, but they wound up mixing and being discovered in layers that actually are interpreted as being older than they really are.
And in some cases, the dates are known only to a factor of two or three.
Right. And the dating in many instances is optical or thermoluminescence, which isn't really a reliable technique. And also, the fact that these discoveries are so isolated is troubling, because if this was behavior that really was a characteristic of these hominids. You'd expect that behavior to be widespread, and you really don't see it that way. So,
well, Fuzz, why don't you give us the earliest undisputed dates for the appearance of sophisticated art and music?
It would be in the neighborhood of about 40,000 years ago.
Right.
In that range, those would be the undisputed dates. You know, Morgan, if you're interested, again, I would refer you to our book, Who Is Adam? But also, there are other books that are written by evolutionary biologists that essentially make the same point that we make. But,
yeah, but Dawn of Human Culture looked interesting. I haven't read it, but I saw you did carry that, and I was kind of curious.
Right. And the reason why we do that is because Richard Klein is an evolutionary biologist. He would probably disagree very strongly with our approach to the question of human origins.
Right.
I've not seen anything to indicate that he would be friendly in the least bit to a Christian interpretation of archaeology. Mm. But his book, The Dawn of Human Culture, and also his textbook, The Human Career, are very good books. And his work actually strongly influenced me as we were preparing the book, Who Was Adam? And so what we do is follow after him, if you will, but from a Christian perspective. But those are two places you can go where he not only talks about his view on the origin of art and music and this sociocultural Big Bang or this great leap forward, but he also talks about the discoveries that he would argue militate against that interpretation and how he addresses them. And so the way in which we address them would really be, again, in a very similar fashion. So there's a chance for you to get kind of an unbiased perspective, if you will, on that topic. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that when you read about these archaeological discoveries, you really have to be very critical and skeptical about what's being claimed, because this is not meant to be condemning of archaeologists who are doing this work or the paleontologists who are doing the work, because they're working with a very limited database. They're trying to take data and reconstruct information that's probably beyond what the data really allows them to reconstruct. By nature, they have to speculate as to what may be going on. And so I think they're doing the best job they can with the data at hand. But I think it's important to realize that not all conclusions are equal, that, you know, garbage in, garbage out. I mean, you can only draw conclusions with a certain certainty that is really predicated on the data that you have at hand. And they're doing the best they have with very limited data. And the nature of the enterprise is very speculative.
I guess the only thing that kind, and I'm not trying to butt heads with you at all.
No. I don't take it that way.
The only, I guess, problem I have with that sort of argument, and this comes around being exposed to young Earth material for so long, is, again, I feel combative saying this, but it almost sounds like you're making an argument that they might make. You know what I mean? Like, oh, well, the dates are messed up. The dating techniques are good, no good. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Well, if I can step in, you know, I mean, you know, you go in even looking in astronomy, you know, just the evidence is overwhelming for a Big Bang. But are there still pieces of evidence out there that appear to say something different? Yes, there are. There are, you know, you go look at Halton Arp, and he's got these discordant redshifts. You know, there are things that you can make an argument to cast doubt on where they're areas where it's a little harder to make to understand the physics, maybe a little, you know, it's a statistical argument, something that's a little sketchier. But if you look at the preponderance of evidence, it's overwhelmingly in favor of a Big Bang universe. But is there still evidence out there that we still have to explain, or that's a little hard? Or, you know, yes, there is, but it resides at the border of our understanding, not where we understand things well.
Right.
And,
okay.
Fuzz, you know, as I look at anthropologists who comment on that part of our Who Is Adam book, I don't hear them complaining about our assessment of these discordant data. I mean, they would agree with us that this is not something that's very well established, and it's a wait-and-see situation.
Right,
I was actually curious to see what the response might have been to the book so far. I've ordered it, but it hasn't shown up yet.
Well, hopefully it'll come soon.
Yeah.
But Morgan, please feel free to call and to ask the hard questions.
Sure.
You know, and I think what Jeff is saying is that, you know, in terms of applying that to this question, it really has to be very much a a weight of evidence type of approach where, again, you are going to have anomalies and you need to look at the weight of evidence, but also pay attention to the anomalies and ask what are they telling you, but also is there a way to explain those anomalies through some type of problem? And, you know, in terms of this idea that we're sounding somewhat like young earthers and we're, you know, casting doubt or raising
dismissing
questions about the dating techniques, you know, we really are saying that, not all dating techniques are equal.
Right.
And you've got to understand the nature of the technique. And to me, if you got a radiocarbon date, I'm going to pay a whole lot of attention to that. Not that it can't be wrong, but I'm going to pay a whole lot of attention to that. If it's a thermoluminescence date, I think it's a ballpark, but I don't think it's a high-precision measurement.
Well, what about – I don't want to get too off track. I'm going to get fired here if I don't show up to work soon. But,
don't let that happen, please.
Yeah. The OSL dating, that seems different than the standard thermoluminescence. Doesn't the OSL just give the lower limit? I thought I read something to that effect.
Well, OSL works well if you get thermoluminescence in addition to the OSL. OSL and thermoluminescence by itself, you're basically getting a limit. But if you got the two, then you got two different decay rates, and with the two, then you can get a fairly decent date. So always be suspicious if all you see is an OSL or a thermoluminescence date. If you see both, then you can give that much higher weight.
Well, one of the figurines we started to talk about earlier that Fuzz responded to, you mentioned where it could have been upper limits. Well, but one of these is like 300,000. It's dated at, and I went, oof, I don't know, that much upper, you know what I mean? That's a pretty big gap you're looking for.
Now, is that detailed in your email that you sent me, that particular example?
It may have been. I can forward it again. I've kept these examples.
Yeah, I would be interested in that.
Yeah, that's fine, sure.
Yeah, and then what I'll do is I'll take a look at it, and then
that'd be great.
If you want to call back at a later date, we can talk about it more.
But, okay.
Because I'm not aware of anything that dates, and I was thinking more with regard to things found in the Blomberg Cave in South Africa, for
example.
Where you're in the 60,000 to 70,000 year range, as opposed to the.
Well, yeah, I'll find that and I'll shoot it off to you. Meanwhile, once again, I better run or I'm going to get hung.
All right, go to work.
Thank you.
And we are going to go ahead and take another phone call. Randy in Collierville, Tennessee. Hello, Randy. How are you doing?
Hi, good morning. Hey, I had a question about a passage in Genesis, specifically chapter 2, and specifically verses 4 through 7. 4 starts out with, "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens." So it seems to be pointing or seems to be saying, okay, this is going to be some more creation detail. And then with 5 and 6, it seems to go off on kind of a sidebar. And the King James, unfortunately, likes to add this word "and" at the beginning of every verse, and I don't think that's textually supported, and it adds the confusion here. But anyway, 5 and 6 start talking about, "And every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew. For the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was not a man to till the ground, but there went up a mist from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground." And so it seems to be setting me up and pointing me, okay, here's the frame of reference, kind of a pre water cycle earth or pre-day two or pre-yom to earth, and it seems to be setting up to say something about that, and then it jumps in verse 7 to day 6 and starts talking about God forming man out of the dust of the ground. And so I'm having trouble understanding just what verses 5 and 6 are even in there for, and they seem to just add confusion in what they're trying to tell me.
Okay, good question, Randy. This is Hugh speaking, and this is addressed in considerable detail in my book, The Genesis Question, making the point that you've got two creation accounts, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, with two very different perspectives and purposes. The purpose of Genesis 1 is God telling us the account of what he did in the way of physical creation miracles to prepare our planet for human beings. And what you notice in Genesis 1 is that there are a number of markers in the text to denote the sequence, the passage of time with respect to these different events taking place. It's set up as 6 days. You got the phrase, "and it was so." You got the phrase, "it was good." And so there's lots of clues in the text that you're getting a chronology, a sequence of physical creation events. So we notice that God creates the universe first, and then he clears the atmosphere from an opaque condition to a translucent condition in day one. You go all the way down to day six, finally to the creation of human beings, male and female. Now, in Genesis 2, it shifts gears and focuses on the spiritual aspects of creation rather than the physical. And by spiritual, I mean God setting up a system of authority and responsibility for the human species. Now, you do get a quick summary of that at the end of Genesis 1, you know, where God tells the male and the female that they're going to be in charge of the planet and they'll be held responsible to manage the resources of the whole planet for the benefit of all life. And you got the added note that green plants will be the base of this entire food chain. But in Genesis 2, we get a quick summary of the physical details. That's verses 5 and 6. Notice it only talks about four items, and it doesn't sequence them. They're not in any particular order. A number of atheists have made a big deal that the order of creation events in Genesis 2, 5, and 6 are different from those in Genesis chapter 1. But the problem there is they're presuming that they're getting a sequence in verses 5 and 6, when in fact you're not. You're getting a summary. God did the following four things. And, you know, then the man shows up, or these are the four things that were not there before the man was created, to be more precise. But then it goes into considerable detail in designating what the responsibilities and the authorities are. Notice that it's sequence. We have God instructing Adam about his responsibilities with respect to the physical creation. Then the next thing that comes on the scene is the soulish creation, where Adam is naming all the birds and mammals. And last of all, he's introduced to that one creature that, like him, is body, soul, and spirit. And meanwhile, God is instructing Adam, and then later Eve as well, and what their authority and responsibilities are. And so what you only have one sentence of that in Genesis 1. You got a whole chapter's worth in Genesis 2, and it's sequence. Whereas what you have in Genesis 1 is a whole chapter focusing on the physical stuff, all strictly sequenced, and in Genesis 2, it's summarized in just a single sentence and only mentions a few of the things. There's no room for confusion, because you can always go back to Genesis 1 and say, okay, this is the chapter that deals with it in detail, and I can go through all this and figure out what's taking place, particularly as you cross-reference Genesis 1 with Proverbs 8, Psalm 104, and Job 38. Those are the three chapters in the Bible that also take you through the six creation days and add a lot of details about the sequence and chronology that you don't have in Genesis 1. But Genesis 2 only parallels Genesis 1 in the sense that it focuses on those physical creation miracles. So if you understand it in that context, there's no contradiction and there's no confusion.
Randy, do you have a follow-up?
Well, yeah, a little bit, I guess. It seems to me that if it was just trying to summarize, it would say, you know, God made all the plants, he made all the animals, and he did this and that, and then man. But it doesn't say that. It says before all that stuff, the plants weren't there and the rain hadn't come yet, so it seems like it's setting the frame of reference back then. That's what confuses me.
Now, Hugh, what do you think about this? Could it be that those particular verses are making reference to the Garden of Eden specifically and not the entirety of the planet?
That's how I see it. It's talking about the Garden of Eden and what God will be doing in the Garden of Eden, you know, this man and this woman, and how God instructs them in the Garden of Eden. But just like with Genesis 1, it begins with a statement of the initial conditions. And so, you know, we've just had this creation story in Genesis 1. Now we're in the Garden of Eden, and God says, by the way, before this man shows up, this is the situation. There were no plants. There was no water cycle in effect. But I took care of all that, and now I'm creating this man. And so it's just kind of giving us a quick overview of what things started out like before the man. And if you go back even earlier, no plants, no continental land masses, no water cycle in effect. But God took care of all that. If you want to see the details, go to Genesis 1. Now I want to talk about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden.
So Randy, are you understanding the passage more in a global context as opposed to looking at it from the perspective of the Garden of Eden?
Yeah, that's helping. That's helping. And kind of as a by the way, that I'll have to go back and read it some more and look at it from that standpoint. And do you agree, Hugh, that this is pre-day two? Do you put the water cycle at day two, just as an aside?
I put the establishing of the water cycle at day two. That doesn't necessarily mean you don't have any water cycling at all before day two, but day two is where you have the setting up of a stable, abundant, long-lasting water cycle.
Okay.
And if you want some clarification on that, Job 38, starting around verse 7 and going through to about verse 15, it gives you more details.
Great. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's go ahead. We're kind of coming down to the end of the hour. Why don't we go ahead and try to take a phone call here from Mike in Little Rock, Arkansas. And Mike, if we can't get to your entire phone call, we will pick you up on the other side of the break. Mike, how are you doing?
Good. My question is, I was watching PBS, and they had different ads going for, like, Nova, I think it was, but they show different scientific facts flash on the screen, and one of them, or two of them, were this universe has no center, and it has no edge. And I was wondering, it seems like from Big Bang cosmology, that the logical conclusion would be that both of those would be true.
That both of those would be true?
Or both of those would not, that it would have a center and it would have an edge?
I'm trying to figure out how to word this, but I think the way to look at this is that, we live in a three-dimension, or a universe that has three spatial dimensions, or the ones that we can grasp and move about in.
Mm-hmm.
Those three spatial dimensions are actually the surface of a four-dimensional sphere, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the center of our universe is actually in that fourth dimension, but we don't have access to it. And it's very, it's the traditional the traditional analogy of your balloon. If you look at a balloon and you're confined to the center or to the surface of the balloon, does the balloon have a center? No, it doesn't, because the center is in the third dimension. You don't have access to it living on the surface of the balloon. And the same way, it doesn't have an edge, and an edge being that you could walk forever around that balloon and you're never going to come to an edge. Similarly with our universe, you could move forever in one direction straight and you're never going to come to the edge of the universe. So the short answer is no, we don't have a center and we don't have an edge.
And yet we have a beginning and an end, and there is a limit to the size of the universe.
Yeah, it's a finite-sized universe, but it doesn't have a physical center where you could go and say, oh, okay, I am at the center of all the mass of my universe. You know,
right.
It's just a relativity thing. Yeah,
here.
It's a little different way of looking at...
This is the reason why people watch big-time wrestling, okay, is when they talk to physicists, they get... answers like that.
Yeah.
What are you talking about, guys?
I'm going to go watch Jerry Springer.
Yeah, yeah.
My brain feel bad.
I'm just teasing. I understood everything you said, Jeff.
Well, you could. Technically, we were at the center. At the very moment of the creation of the universe, you have all the matter and energy and space-time dimensions squished into an infinitesimal volume. But that's the last time anything's at the center.
Well, or you can say that the center is everywhere, so we're at the center right now.
Well, another analogy, I remember during the days of the British Empire, Queen Victoria used to say that London was the center of the earth. London's on the surface of the earth, but everything's on the surface of the earth in terms of human beings and cities, so every city can claim to be, quote, the center. So it's the same kind of analogy. All the stars and galaxies, even the space-time dimensions, are confined to the surface of the universe. So since we're a long ways after the creation event, there's nothing at the center. It's impossible to go to the center. Although you can look back over the surface of the universe, and when you do that, you're looking back in time. The farther away you look, the farther back in time you're seeing. And there we're seeing the universe when it had a smaller surface than it has today.
Right. Well, so if the universe was the surface of a balloon, as the balloon shrinks back towards the beginning of time, it's eventually going to collapse down on itself and be...
At the center.
At the center, right.
Okay.
That is,
you mean, Mike, you mean you understand in this?
I kind of do that.
You're getting there?
Help me out.
Well,
oh, man.
Let me give you just one more thing, because this is a common or misconception I've seen about the Big Bang, is that in the Big Bang, you've got all this space and time exist, and your matter is exploding out into this pre-existing space.
Right.
And that's an inaccurate way of looking at it. The Big Bang is actually the creation of the space and time itself as well. So there is no.
There was nothing for it to explode into.
Exactly. The Big Bang is the creation of space, time, matter, and energy. And it's as the space is expanding, then all of the matter and everything is going with it. But there is no center to that space, just the same way there is no center to your balloon.
And really, that's the reason why Big Bang cosmology has such profound theological implications that resonate with the Christian faith. Okay, gentlemen, this program and the ministry at Reasons to Believe is really not about talking about how the latest scientific discoveries provide evidence for the Christian faith. Really, what our organization is about at the end of the day is evangelism and using science as a tool or a platform to reach people for faith in Christ. And Hugh, this past week, or actually 2 weeks ago now, you took a trip to Boston where you were engaged in some outreach events. And so why don't you go ahead and tell us what you've been up to and how things went
in
Boston.
Well, first of all, I want to thank the three of you for filling in while I've been finishing up this book on our testable creation model.
It was our pleasure. I'm not sure if it was the listener's pleasure, but it was surely our pleasure.
It's been fun on my end.
It really took my stepping up. I think I've been gone like 3 or 4 weeks. But it really took that to get the book done. I mean, for about a four-week period, I was putting in 14 to 16 hours a day just cranking on that book, trying to get it done. We did ship it off to the publisher this past Friday. A few of the appendices will be shipped off hopefully today, if not today, tomorrow. So that book is out, and we're hoping that it'll be released fairly soon.
And this is an important book because this book really addresses what's becoming fairly prominent in our culture today, namely this war, if you will, between intelligent design and between evolution and how it's impacting science education. So this book that you're working on is really a very important.
Well, it addresses the war. And, we look at a number of participants. I mean, you've got the naturalists, the atheists. You've got the young earth creationists. You've got the theistic evolutionists. You've got the intelligent design people. And what I document is how the war has become more and more contentious, but for reasons that shouldn't exist. And so we basically lay out a different strategy for lowering the hostility and the contention in these creation-evolution debates. And that strategy is to have these different positions tested through models, detailed models that have explanatory power and predictive success. And then we can compare the different interpretations by how well they explain the data that we now have in hand and how successfully they predict future scientific discoveries. But a good chunk of the book is laying out the reasons to believe biblical testable creation model.
You do talk some of this through in your book, A Matter of Days. How is this different from that?
Well, A Matter of Days simply looks at putting the young Earth model to the test side by side with the old Earth creationist model.
So it's the same approach, but applied to controversy within the church.
Right. This has a much broader perspective.
The new book does.
And we also realize that we needed a single book that actually summarizes the full extent of the reasons to believe creation model. So this book does that. We're relying on books like Who is Adam and The Origins of Life and the Creator and the
Cosmos
to lay out pieces of that model, like the cosmological piece, the human origins piece. So this model does not attempt to describe the entire model in the detail those books do, but does give you a detailed enough summary that you can see what the model is, see what kinds of predictions flow to the model, see the means by which you can test its explanatory power, and basically challenges everybody else to step up to the plate. And then we can settle these creation-evolution debates without all this hostility and contention. We let the predictions and the explanatory power determine which model is better than the other models. And then we kind of lay out a humility theology, if you like, where we make the point because we're human, none of us is capable of developing a perfect, detailed model. and therefore every model must be in a state of improvement. And I think that's something that's bothered me about creation-evolution debates, is you've got these different positions that are totally intransigent. You know, we have all the answers. This is the way it's got to be. Everybody else has got to be wrong. Well, given how limited we humans are in being able to investigate the record of nature and the causes behind it, none of us can claim to have a model that is complete and perfect. And in that sense, everyone needs to have the humility to realize we have models, but they're in process. And here's how we can improve the models, and here's how we can get rid of models that are failing the tests. How do we determine which models are failing the tests? That's what the book is all about. And yeah, it's a great relief after 2.5 years of work to have it actually shipped off to the publisher.
Now, is it written at a level more for the layperson, or is it going to be difficult like some of our other books have been?
It won't be as difficult as, say, Who is Adam, or The Origins of Life, or The Creator in the Cosmos. It's written at a much more lay level than those books. And when I started the book, it was at a very lay level. But the different editors and scientists around the table here felt that we needed a lot more
detail.
Had to be more comprehensive. And actually, I think that advice was good in the sense that this book needs to stand alone. It's going to be isolated and attacked by people with different views. And so there needs to be enough in the book that it can withstand those kinds of critiques. And therefore, it's not quite as at lay a level as I had planned it in the beginning. But I think it's still very much a lay book. It's about twice as long as what I started off with. But, I mean, if you want a book that kind of lays out our whole creation model, this is the book to get. And I guarantee it'll be a lot easier to understand than, say, The Creator in the Cosmos, which I still think is a fairly lay-level book.
Well, and something that's exciting is that typically when our books go to the publisher, it's about a year from the time that they receive them till the time that the book sees the light of day, so to speak.
So when is this one expected out?
Well, I understand it, and I could be wrong here, but I understand that Nav Press, who's the publisher, is going to fast-track the book. Now, whatever that means, but it should be coming out more rapidly than typically what we see.
Yeah, they're eager to get the book out quickly. However, I just heard this morning they've not been able to find an editor to do the initial work, so it could be delayed at least a month even on the fast-track. But we have some events coming up this spring that would be really terrific if we had the book ready. But hey, back to your question. In the midst of all that, I took a quick trip to Boston on the proviso that when I wasn't speaking in Boston, I could be working on the book. So I was working hard there in Boston. But I appreciate, Fuzz, that you went ahead of me and did those events with the Albany chapter. And a lot of those Albany chapter folks came out and supported what we were doing in the Boston area, especially at the University of Massachusetts, which is about halfway between Boston and Albany, New York.
So you spoke at the University of Massachusetts Amherst?
Yeah, spoke at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And that was interesting in that typically, you know, we get on campuses because some undergraduate Christian club sponsors us. This event was sponsored by the chaplaincy. University of Massachusetts is a state university, and yet they have a chaplain. And the chaplain, I was thrilled to discover, was one of the physics professors there. And so it was really the physics department that made all this happen. The chaplain, who himself is a physicist and another physicist, really did the bulk of the work of making this happen. Bottom line, Fuzz, I think we're going to see an Amherst chapter develop. Amherst is basically a university town. But there was so much interest generated that evening that, and we have a number of, PhD level scientists that are prepared to get behind and make that happen. So that was a big encouragement to both Amherst and Boston chapters that we could get a campus chapter going there. What made that event work really well is the first guy that came to the microphone testified of how he began his life as a Catholic, and when he was a young boy, he turned away from that, pursued atheism because he got interested in science. He thought science was supporting an atheist worldview, and he told the entire audience through the microphone that particular night was a night that he had come back to God. And he says, now I see that the science is supporting a biblical worldview rather than contradicting it. And, it's always great to have the first person at the microphone make that kind of a testimony. And that virtually happened at the rest of my events in the Boston area as well. I spoke at a couple of different churches. We had a chapter meeting. I think what excites me the most is just how the chapters are really growing there in the New England area. And the Boston chapter is predominantly headed up by physicists from MIT and Lincoln Labs, and there's some neuroscientists that are getting involved. Great people. And, you know, I spent most of my time when I was being driven back and forth. There was a physicist that drove me around, and this physicist is just speaking and teaching all the time using our material. And several other physicists are doing that as well. And I think somewhere down the road they're planning to do a creation conference.
Wow, that's exciting.
Was this university talk that you gave, was that a talk or was it kind of this Veritas forum kind of thing where you had a sort of a debate or?
Well, no, I was by myself and you know, I suggested the topic, how about the latest scientific evidences for God? And they said, well, that's good, but we'd really like to hear your testimony. So I gave my personal testimony how I came to faith in Christ, and yeah, that's pretty science-loaded anyway. And then I segued from that to some of the latest scientific discoveries, and we had about 3 hours of Q&A after that.
Okay.
And the Q&A, as Fuzz knows, is always the best part of a university event. You get all these people coming to the microphone, their questions and their skeptical responses, and it's always great to be able to interact with them at that level.
So if... you guys who are listening to this program wonder why on earth are we so excited about science and how science relates to the Christian faith. This is the reason why, is because it's through, again, this vehicle we're able to reach people who otherwise would be resistant to the Christian faith, who think that science really is an intellectual foe of Christianity. And when they realize that science actually supports the Christian faith, they are open to the ultimately to the gospel. And this is what really is very exciting to us.
Well, Fuzz, did you get to meet Beth Nichols when you were back there? She was featured in our Staying Connected magazine. And what they did, and I spoke on Sunday morning, is they did a video clip of how she came to faith in Christ. She's a science teacher, teaches 8th grade science, and had a similar story to the young man at the University of Massachusetts. Started off a Catholic, walked away from it, pursued atheism. But it was the book, The Genesis Question, that turned her around. And, of course, when she said that on the video clip, those books immediately sold out. So, yeah, it's just fun hearing these stories of how people's lives have been changed through the discovery that science is the ally of the Christian faith, not the enemy of the Christian faith.
Exactly. So if people want to know more about where we're going to be speaking at and how they can go and attend one of our events live, they can go to our website at reasons.org and they can learn where we're going to be and when we're going to be there. Okay, before the break, we said that we would have a discussion about the life and times of Hermann Bondi. So, Jeff, go ahead and take this away.
Well, this is prompted. A fellow just passed away in September of 2005 here, but it was a very well-respected, well-known cosmologist and mathematician. One would think I'd know how to say that word now, but you know, he was born in 1919, and he was born to Jewish parents and lived in Vienna, Austria. And so, as you might expect, he's had a rather eventful, to say the least, time through college with World War II and everything. He ended up getting out of Vienna and went to Britain to wanted to work with Arthur Eddington, you know, who was another very well known maybe one of the premier cosmologists and astronomers of the time, and that's who he wanted to work with. You know, very gifted, very talented, especially mathematically gifted young boy that. Bondi was, and while he, in fact, it made a comment that a very resourceful person as well said that while he was on, he ended up in an intern camp on the Isle of Man, and he said in the obituary it wrote, you know, with typical resourcefulness, he set up a camp university at which he gave lectures on mathematics. You know, so obviously very passionate about his mathematics. It turns out,
Was this like a torture camp, or?
You know? I don't know.
It's bad enough that I'm an intern here in this camp, and now I have to listen to these mathematics lectures. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
there are people who like it.
Yeah, there are. Yes, no, but you know, taking the very in a bad situation and figuring out how to make good out of it.
Point taken.
But. You know, in the process of being in these intern camps, he met up with Thomas Gold, who actually turned out to be a collaborator of his much later on after the war was over and things kind of settled down a little bit. And then he eventually met up with Sir Fred Hoyle. Well, it was Fred Hoyle at the time, but you know, Sir Fred Hoyle, and that's kind of where the relevance of all this comes in. Is, you know, he, Bondi, and Hoyle and Gold went on to develop the steady state cosmology theory. You know, that wasn't the only thing that Bondi worked in. He did some other work in, you know, obviously did quite a bit of mathematics and stellar formation, stellar modeling. With his wife, and in fact, was a student of Fred Hoyle's as well, and so he developed this steady state cosmology largely in response to some observational difficulties with the Big Bang model at the time. You know, and as most are aware, Fred Hoyle was the one who coined the term Big Bang, kind of a derisive term what we see is very strong evidence for a cosmic creator. So Bondi and Hoyle and Gold worked on this steady state cosmology theory, which, you know, fit the observations of the day. But what the most significant difference was that the steady state cosmology, there was no beginning and there would be no end, presumably. You know, the universe looked the same a billion years ago to 100 billion years ago, and will look the same as it will, you know, billions and trillions of years into the future.
And so in terms of a brief history of cosmology, prior to the 1900s, the view was the universe was infinite and eternal.
Correct, yes.
And in the early 1900s, with Edwin Hubble's observations of an expanding universe, with Einstein's theory of general relativity applied to the universe, the cosmological community began to realize that perhaps the universe indeed had a beginning, that it wasn't eternal, but it was finite in age and extent.
Correct.
But yet the observations as the decades transpired really were not necessarily exclusively lining up with Big Bang cosmology, that there were problems, and that's what motivated in part this proposition for the steady state model.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. There were, you know, in particular, among other things, that at times there were stars that were observed to be older than what the universe appeared to be in age. And so, you know, how can you have that? Well, in a steady state cosmology, you don't have that problem because the universe is infinitely old, and so there is no beginning to speak of. One point that the person who wrote the obituary.
By the way, you didn't mention where this is published.
Yeah, this obituary is published in Nature, the October 6th, 2005 version of Nature. And he made a point of noting that Hermann Bondi was very heavily influenced in his philosophy of science by Karl Popper. And one particular aspect of Karl Popper, probably the most notable trait of Karl Popper's philosophy of science, is that scientific theories must be testable, verifiable, and falsifiable. And so, that, you know, one of the things about the steady state cosmology is that it made very precise or very specific predictions of what you were going to find as you went out and observed in the universe. And so,
as does Big Bang cosmology.
As does Big Bang cosmology, right. And, you know, so, you go out, you put your theory, you make it as best and as detailed as you can, you put the predictions out there, and you go out, you make the observations, and see where the chips fall. And, you know, to his credit, as Bondi, evidence began to roll in over the next 20 and 30 years, especially with the discovery of the cosmic microwave background in 1965, he said, hey, wait, there's no way to solve this problem. There's no good way to solve that problem from a steady state cosmology. So he said, okay, that's wrong. And, you know, he was just uninterested in steady state cosmology after that. And, you know, I think that's particularly relevant where, you know, we were talking about with Hugh the last segment, where we have this testable creation model is, you know, we don't need to argue and fight about who, you know, what philosophy is better or whatever. You know, you put out there and say, hey, these are my tests. This is what this theory predicts. This is what you expect to find, and then go out and make the observation, see where the chips fall, and lo and behold, that will tell you whether your model's good or not. Now, it may be your model can be modified slightly to account for that, and you say, okay, well, this model's still got some validity. It may mean that you need a wholesale rewrite, and I think with the observation of the cosmic microwave background, you really needed a wholesale rewrite of the steady state cosmology to make that look good. And so, you know, he just abandoned it. I think that's a good example of the scientific process at work there, that you know, he wasn't so tied to an aversion to a beginning. He wasn't so tied to some philosophical idea. But when the data came in and that theory didn't hold water, said, okay, that's not it, and moved on and
gave it up,
adopted a Big Bang cosmology. Mm-hmm. So.
You know, and if people are interested in learning more about the history of cosmology, a great resource would be Hugh's book, The Fingerprint of God.
Yes.
In addition to that, the book Creator in the Cosmos as well. But I think it's interesting because, in a sense, the steady state model was really, as you pointed out, Jeff, a serious competitor to Big Bang cosmology. And the implications of the steady state model are pretty profound, theologically speaking. I mean, if the universe essentially is a steady state universe, then there is no evidence for a beginning. And if there is no evidence for a beginning, there is no need or necessity for a beginner, which we would argue is the God of the Bible.
Well, and even beyond that, the vast majority of design evidence we talk about disappears because, you know, you got origin of life, all these things that need to be the way they are. They just eventually happen in an infinitely old universe.
So. Excellent point. And so I think it's significant for, you know, people to realize that this model really failed in the face of the scientific evidence, and that Big Bang cosmology really is supported and is the best model from a scientific standpoint. And of course, with that is evidence for the work of a transcendent creator. But I think it's also important, too, as you're pointing out, that many times we tend to lampoon scientists and dismiss what they're saying because we just figure that they are so committed to a particular worldview that
correct.
In the face of evidence, they simply are not going to respond. They've already made up their mind, and that we need to be that we just simply need to wash our hands of trying to deal with the scientific community. But I think what we find here at Reasons to Believe is that if you actually present a well-thought-out, compelling argument for the Christian faith, that people will listen. Mm-hmm. And I think with this creation model approach that Hugh was talking about in the last segment, that's a way in which we can model what we are admiring in Hermann Bondi.
Right.
Here's what we think is going on. Here's how you can test whether or not we're correct. And if we're not correct, then we're going to either have to modify our model or abandon it altogether. But I think that's a very compelling way to present the Christian faith. It encourages dialogue and interaction as opposed to really rancor and debate.
Well, it definitely encourages scientific advancement, too, because if you go out and you say, okay, these are my predictions, it forces you to really understand your theory well instead of, you know, it's explained what we've seen so far, and you know, but it really forces you to dig in and say, okay, where can we test this that distinguishes it from that competitor's model? So having you know, competing models probably did more to help solidify evidence for the Big Bang universe. The steady state cosmology being there did a lot to solidify the evidence for a Big Bang universe.
The you know, this kind of unveils the problem in the creation models that we're talking about. People will accuse us of hanging onto our model because of a faith that we have. I mean, you know, we have faith in the Bible. We're not likely to give up that faith, so we're going to hang on to our model whether it agrees with the facts or not. And what we're trying to do is to, at the same time as we do genuinely hang on to the faith that we have, that we are open to the idea that there may be improper interpretations of our faith or of the science, as it may be. And I think another thing that needs to be stressed, too, and that is that scientists who are naturalists, they have faith, too. They have faith in that philosophical, that metaphysical notion called naturalism. And they're interpreting everything in the light of that faith. And they are just as guilty or just as likely to be hanging on to that viewpoint as a Christian is to hang on to his faith in the Bible. But he needs to be, as we have seen here, Hermann Bondi was, willing to acknowledge, hey, that theory doesn't work very well. I have to go back to the drawing boards here and work out a different model.
Well, you know, and coupled in with that, you know, talking about just, you know, this is a very polarized debate. And, you know, one of the last comments that they put in about Hermann Bondi, and I'll just read it here, is, although he could be ruthless when confronted with flawed arguments, whatever their source, he respected the intellectually honest opponent working from different axioms. And I remember a pastor that I had when I was in graduate school and lived back in Ames, Iowa. We were talking. I forget what exactly the context of the conversation was, but he made a point to me once. He goes, "Before you argue against a position, you should make sure you could argue for it."
Ooh.
You know, and what I take this comment here about Bondi is that though he may disagree with you, he had the facility and the respected people enough that he would listen and make sure he understood what they were saying. He may disagree with the starting points, but he understood their arguments and would engage them at that level. And so much of what I've seen, between the church and the scientific community is just a lack of
appreciation
of willingness to go out and really understand what what from the Christian community what the scientists are saying and from the scientists what the right. Christian community is saying.
It's really what integrity is, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. Yeah. So,
and we're going to go ahead and take a phone call from our good friend Kenny in Milton, Florida. Hello, Kenny. How's it going?
Going pretty good. Been reading through the Who Is Adam book. And up to about chapter 6 or 7, so maybe later in the book it answers the two questions I got. I first wanted to make a comment. I think it was about last week. Somebody was talking about the vegetarian diet for the animals in Genesis at the end of Genesis chapter 1, and I always looked at it. One of the things I noticed about it was the you have on day 5 you have creatures of the air and creatures of the sea. Then on day 6, the land, mammals, and humans, and then when God tells man what he's to rule over, it's all those creatures again. But then when you get to this, quote, vegetarian diet for the animals, there's a big missing point, all the creatures in the sea. So he didn't tell them to eat vegetables, so that can't be an argument for no death before the fall of Adam, because all the creatures in the sea, they couldn't have all been eating seaweed. But,
Good point, Kenny. And I think the point you're making is consistent, if I recall,
with what the caller was making
as well. Yeah. Yeah.
But my questions were, as somebody who I think knows your creation and flood model pretty well, the book has me confused in chapters 4 and 5. 4 and 5, I think it is. It says you talk about the evidence against bottlenecking being able to take place for evolutionists, but from a flood model, we would have a worst-case scenario for bottlenecking. And then my second question was, you seem to say in there that there's really no good evidence for humans prior to 40,000 years ago, yet again, part of the creation model puts the flood close to 40,000 years ago, and with the genealogies in Chapter 5, you would have to put the creation of Adam and Eve much further back. And so I'm questioning those two ideas. Well, why can't there be bottlenecking because our flood model says there is? And how can Adam and Eve, how can it be consistent, the 40,000 years in the fossil record be consistent with the RTB model, when the RTB model has human beings created prior to 40,000 years?
Okay, Kenny, two wonderful questions. And I think the first thing we need to do is explain to people what is meant by bottlenecking in case they're not aware of that term. And this is a term that geneticists use to describe a situation where a population undergoes a catastrophic collapse. And what happens is a fair degree of genetic diversity then collapses down to a very restricted level of genetic diversity. And so the argument is, when we look at the genetic makeup of modern humans from that genetic diversity patterns of people groups around the world, it looks as if humanity originates from a single man and single woman in a very small population. We would argue that that's evidence for biblical creation and for the validity of the biblical creation account of humanity. But an evolutionist would argue that that is merely reflecting a collapse of either a pre-human hominid population or a human population to a very small number that then recovered from that collapse and then began to expand in number and expand in extent around the world. And the point that we make in the book is that that bottlenecking explanation is plausible. However, it doesn't take into account work done with regard to extinctions. because we now know that when you see severe bottlenecking of populations, those populations are driven to extinction. They very seldom, if ever, have the capability of recovering from that. And so your question is, why is that illegitimate for the evolutionist, but yet legitimate for us at the time of the flood event? And that's a really good question that, frankly, Kenny, until you raised it, I never even thought of it. So I appreciate the callers to this program who are always asking us these difficult and very legitimate and good questions. And, you know, a couple of ways to respond to that. One would be there could be have been a supernatural intervention that prevented the extinction of humanity. That's kind of a hand-waving explanation that uses God to get us out of a jam, and may or may not be the best way to approach it. Another possibility is that because of humanity's capability to reason and think, and because of that allowed for the survival of the bottlenecking situation after the flood. However, the problem with that is, could you not then say, well, maybe these very first humans that survived this catastrophic population collapse too could have reasoned their way in such a way to avoid extinction? Maybe another possibility has to do with the genetic pristine nature of the earliest humans. Perhaps by that point in time, there was still enough of a pristine genetic makeup of human beings that they were able to withstand the bottlenecking event at the flood, whereas from an evolutionary perspective, the bottlenecking that occurred, quote-unquote, according to their model, would not have worked because of the need for genetic diversity. And I don't know if you get what I'm driving at here, Kenny, but the reason why genetic diversity is so critical for survival when species are threatened with extinction is because that genetic diversity is a way to overcome the mutational load on the population. Over time, populations will accrue mutations, and by accruing these mutations, they then become susceptible for extinction. But through genetic diversity, you're scrambling the genetic information in such a way to kind of mitigate the effect of that mutational load on the population. However, if you have a catastrophic collapse, that genetic diversity is lost, and therefore there's no way to dampen that effect. However, if you have a genetically pristine sample, you really don't have a need for diversity because you don't have that mutational load on the population. And maybe that is what ultimately is a way to explain the difference between the flood event and an evolutionary appeal to bottlenecking. I don't know, Kenny, if you buy what I'm selling here, but that would be one possible way to explain it.
I was just thinking as you were saying that, if it was, you know, we pretty much assume it was pristine to begin with. That if I remember right, when Neanderthals and modern humans were compared mitochondrially, humans over the last 25,000 years hadn't really changed that much. Is that right?
Well, yes. That's one way to look at that data. That there's. It's not that there hasn't been evolution of the mitochondrial DNA sequences. It's just that the evolution has not produced a qualitatively different DNA sequence over that time span.
I was just wondering if maybe there could have been as little or less mutations prior to the flood then, and therefore a bottlenecking with our intelligence. You know, we're working to try and keep other species from going extinct based on that.
Well, Kenny, it's quite possible because prior to the flood, again, we would argue that the long lifespans in the Bible, in Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, were legitimately long lifespans. And, mm-hmm. and in order for that to be in effect from a biochemical standpoint, there would need to be hyperactive repair mechanisms, and that could actually prevent the mutations occurring in the DNA molecule because that repair mechanism would essentially overcome the insults from chemistry and physics that would cause the mutations. So maybe there was a more genetically pristine sample at the time of the flood.
Can I ask a question, Fuzz? The studies that were done on bottlenecking that suggested that they always ended up in extinction. What was the reason for the sudden decrease in the population? Was it a genetic load, you said?
With regard to humans?
Yeah, well, or any creature
be some environmental factors began causing a loss in numbers in the population, or it could be, you know, some kind of disease going through the population or something like that.
I mean,
that.
There is a difference perhaps between the sort of naturalistic evolutionary kind of bottlenecks that these guys are talking about and the flood, which was, you know, a temporary change in the environment. You know, it killed all the people except a few. But the environment kind of went back to the way it was normally. And being that there were a few humans here, they were able to survive in that environment as they had done prior.
Right.
Well, and I mean, you know, just from maybe a little different, you know, you're talking about the humans being able to reason their way out. Would it be, I mean, would an evolutionist argue that, you know, humans 40,000 years ago basically have equivalent facilities of what we have now? Or is there something, you know, presumably the humans came onto the scene very quickly then and then have progressed to where we are now? Or,
well,
you know,
I think
could you make an argument that from a creation model, we expect humans to have the facility we do now and thus have that reasoning ability, but from an evolutionary perspective, you might expect that reasoning to be more primitive and not so effective?
That's a legitimate point, Jeff. I think that that's right. That could very well be correct.
Okay.
Kenny,
from a biblical perspective, could we argue the fact that God told Noah and them afterwards to be fruitful and multiply, and maybe he, you know, gave him a heads up?
that could be. You know, I don't know, Kenny, if those are satisfactory answers, but I think you raise a very good question that I've frankly never thought about before. So thanks.
Well, the bottlenecking in that case could
thanks
be,
for making my job harder, huh?
Or the Bible.
What's that?
I said from that kind of perspective, then the bottlenecking evidence could be evidence for the biblical model.
Yes.
Not necessarily against.
Exactly.
And what about the evidence you said in there that there's no good evidence prior to 40,000 years ago for Homo sapiens, yet the biblical model would say Homo sapiens been around longer than 40,000?
Kenny, that's a good question as well. And I think the answer to this question, and I don't know if again, you'll find it satisfactory, but it has to do with really you're stuck with the data that you have, and you've got to do the best you can with the data that you have. And the problem is that the genetic techniques that are used to date the origin of humanity, or at least the timing of humanity's origin, give you really very crude ballpark estimates. The fossil record and the archaeological record, in principle, would be more rigorous ways to do the dating. But with regard to fossilization, you really are subjected to the vagaries of the burial process and the preservation process. And so you never are quite sure when you see fossils whether or not they really reflect the true timing for the origin of that particular species, or that's really the first piece of evidence you have for their existence. And obviously, the larger the population size, the more likely you are to have fossilization occurring. Also, you know, you have the archaeological record, which again is a good indicator as to when things began. But there again, the problem is you're looking at really, for the most part, wide-scale production of those artifacts as opposed to necessarily the first production of the artifacts. Plus, everything that you're looking at is happening in a very narrow window of time. But your tools for measuring the timing of events are fairly crude. And so the resolution of your measurement tools are not really sufficient to resolve what's happening because of the narrowness of the time frame. So the problem is you're going to have some level of uncomfort or discomfort in terms of dates not exactly corresponding in a linear fashion to the way that you would expect them to. And I don't know that with the data that we have, we could do any better than what we have, other than to say, approximately humanity originated in this time window. This is approximately we think the flood is. And the dates from the fossil record, the archaeological record, and the genetic record all seem to be at least broadly consistent with the sequence of those events. And I don't know that may not be satisfying to you, Kenny, but I don't know really how else to respond to that question.
Well, hopefully in time we expect to get better measurements, more data, more precise dates.
Exactly.
And our model would predict that this is what we would expect. A consistency like you're talking about, Kenny, but we don't see it right now.
You know, the problem is, you know, anthropology is not origin of life research, nor is it even less cosmology. You know, it's not a hard science where mm-hmm. you can, you know, I'm envious of the physicists that have the anthropic principle that can make these calculations to, you know, 120 places after the decimal point and make proclamations, whereas, you know, in anthropology, you know, you've got this thing that you can bracket between 30 and 40,000 years, even with the best dating methods.
Well, that's a little bit of a misnomer, because you go back 15, 20 years in cosmology, and we had this problem of stars being older than the universe.
Right.
But your universe was 15 plus or minus 5 billion, and your stars were 17 plus or minus 8 billion. I mean, you know, it just the level of tools. And, you know, the nice thing about cosmology is that it's very clear what measurements you need to make. And so you just ask the question, can we build tools to go out and do that? I imagine that's a little bit harder in anthropology, but this situation is not so dissimilar from where the cosmologists were 10 years ago.
Well, that's good to know. I don't feel so bad. But also couple that with this idea now that when humanity began to migrate, they began to migrate very rapidly. And we didn't really emphasize that a lot in the book, because some of the work towards this end has been published since the book really went to press, or at least went to the publisher and was at the point of no return. But there's been some more work done indicating that there indeed was this migration along this coastal superhighway through Southeast Asia. So all of a sudden you've got people showing up in Australia that, and it almost looks as if it's overlapping with the timing of humanity's origin. You know, but what's happening is there's this very rapid migration once humanity began to migrate after the flood. And again, you couple that with some ambiguity about the dating, and you've got this, you know, messy situation. But I think in a broad sense, there's agreement. And, the best we can do is hope for refinement in measurement techniques and just a more developed fossil and archaeological record.
All righty, then.
So I don't know, Kenny, if you got any comments or like to respond, but that's the best I can do right now.
Hey, that sounds pretty good.
Okay, good.
And I'll just keep coming up with more questions.
Hey, go ahead. I really appreciate your contribution to the show, Kenny, and how studious you are with respect to these issues. So
one
thanks
of these
a lot.
Days, I might actually send in that paper I told Chris I was going to email her, but that was like 9 months ago, and I've been three quarters done with it for about 9 months to a year. So
sounds like projects we work on here at Reasons to Believe. So don't get discouraged.
All righty, y'all have a good one.
Well, you know what? The show's over with, and thank you very much for listening to Creation Update. Join us next week when we talk about the latest scientific discoveries and how they provide compelling evidence for the Christian faith.
This has been a presentation of the Ministry of Reasons to Believe. If you would like to know more about other resources offered by Reasons to Believe, or have questions about issues related to science and the Christian faith, please visit our website at reasons.org or call us toll-free at 800-482-7836.